Team Time.
Hi, welcome to Team Time. I'm your host, Debbie Waith, and I'm here to share with you a series of podcasts aimed at supporting those leading and in teams. I'm going to share my personal story as a woman who has led many teams in large organisations and in several countries. I've also been coaching leaders and teams for over 10 years, and I'll draw on this experience to support your journey as a leader and all the other hats that you might wear.
Hi, welcome back to Team Time. For those of you that've listened over the last few weeks, you'll know this is my third episode relating to racial inequality, particularly in the UK. And I, in the earlier two, have been exploring my own relationship and journey with racial inequality and white privilege as a white woman. And what I'm learning as I look more deeply into the history in the United Kingdom in particular, related to black people and people of colour. So in the first episode, you may recall, I explored what that history was a little more and some of the important concepts such as non-racist versus anti-racist. And as well as what it felt like to kind of have this label of white privilege. In the second episode, I, as someone who has taught and consulted for many years, shared a number of tips or techniques that I would offer to leaders who are hosting these inevitably complex conversations. And of course, these conversations can show up in any of the marginal communities, but my focus at this point was on race. And so today I wanted in this final of the three episodes at this point to kind of take the lens out even further and just put some focus at the system and sort of structural aspect of racism. So that's where we're going to end up in the discussion. As I did on the second episode, I want to share what I've learned or reflected on this week. When I started this particular journey and the podcasts, it really is in the spirit of, I think we've become too accustomed to the horror stories that we see in the news, you know, every few months about some act, often by the police, involving a person of colour or a black person that horrifies us, certainly for a few weeks. And we're outraged and we're, filled with anger and grief for what has happened. And yet nothing significant changes. And so something in me moved following the death of George Floyd in the US a few weeks ago. Something just changed to say, actually, enough is enough. This is showing up in inequalities related to housing, to medical care, to schooling, to work opportunities, to policing, to media. I've been reflecting quite a lot on some of the hard messages that it brings. And the one that I guess I keep coming back to is that racism isn't, a problem to be fixed by black people. It has to be fixed within a white community. And not just those that are committing racist acts, but actually it's the perpetuation of racism being, acceptable because the institutions, because it shows up in our institutions and in how our society works. So what I have been reflecting for myself is, we do all have biases. It's part of being human. And yet a number of us, I'm sure, would not want those biases to translate to behaviours that we othered or lessened people as a consequence. And so the only, you know, thing we can do is try to raise our personal awareness of those unconscious behaviours and those unconscious biases that drive the behaviours. And I talked on the last episode about Project Implicit that Harvard run, which gives you access to taking some random association tests by which you can learn your own unconscious biases better. We do all have the biases. You know, what we're not aiming for in this debate is to expect to rid of biases. We acknowledge that they are just part of the human experience. I thought Renée Edo-Lodge in her book, Why I'm No Longer Speaking to White People About Race, makes a really interesting distinction between prejudice as being something committed at an individual level, obviously based on bias, and racism, which involves power and systems. And, you know, we can't tackle one, the individual prejudice, without tackling the other, meaning the institutions and systems that enable those prejudices to continue to thrive. I listened to a podcast this past week, which was Emily Kwong, Shortwave from NPR, and she had on as a guest Dr. Pragya Garwal, who is a behavioural and data scientist, author, academic and researcher, as well as journalist, having published a book called Sway, Unravelling Unconscious Bias. And so she was sharing some of her personal experience and her research in relation to unconscious bias. And one of the things that I find really helpful and interesting was the connection, if you like, the cyclical nature of systemic and structural biases that reinforce the individual bias, and one feeds into the other. And I think that's something for us as leaders to pay attention to, in that this isn't going to be progressed at purely an individual level. And one of the reasons I've been reflecting on it is to try and better understand the role of things like unconscious bias training within the perspective of systemic racial inequality. Of course, it plays an important role, but it alone can't change the deeply embedded narrative and frameworks that exist within large institutions. What else won't change this on their own are people of colour and black people. That's my personal reflection. It feels to me that there are similarities with the movement around gender that has, you know, had a lot of focus and attention in the last 10 to 15 years. You know, when I was in those discussions and meetings, there was a long time where it was only women in the room. And it took us quite a long time before we realised that actually not only did men need to be in the room, men had to be part of the solution. It wasn't for women to fix, it was upon all of us. And for me, that is the same corollary, if you like, around race. We cannot leave it to the marginalised or the minority voices to expect to fix the wider system. There has to be a collective level of accountability upon us all. And inevitably, you know, whether it was the gender discussion or the race discussion, what it talks to is a shift in power. And that is something that we typically will shy away from because, you know, I kind of liken it to when you're preparing to have another child, having already had a child, and you worry, you know, will there be enough love to go around? And of course, love can grow, love can expand. I don't think it works like that with power. I don't think it's that power grows as we let more people in. There is whatever, you know, power is in that sort of invisible way, but it's shared. And so it does mean that somebody and some probably collective bodies will need to give up some or lose some power. So if it can't be tackled alone at the individual level, something has to happen above us as individuals at a level where we come together and organise. And of course, you know, I've talked about, you know, that could be in schools, that could be in the judicial system, that could be in how we, how the social services work in the country. And one of the key players at an organisational level has to be business. It has to play a role in reshaping societal norms, just as it's doing now in the last few years, certainly around climate change. You know, for many, many years, marginalised voices on the periphery have been talking about climate change. And certainly my background is in energy, and I remember distinctly there being movements around 12 years ago to get to a place where in the last year or two there seems to have been traction. But it was only when businesses started to take a more proactive role, because at a governmental level alone, we can't mandate how people should behave. At a business level, in terms of how we employ people, where how we fund things, there is a lot more influence. So I think businesses and organisations play a fundamental role here to set the new standard, if you like, with regards to race equality. I've been doing some research on the impact of diversity and inclusion programmes, because, of course, those typically are the ways that organisations have tried for decades now to try to ensure that the diversity of their population is well represented and you know, has a voice in how the organization is run. And I'll be honest with you, as I've kind of gone through, you know, papers and articles, it's quite inconclusive as to what actually works. I'm going to share with you some thoughts as to where I've got to in relation to what seems to work better. But the question I want to start with, and I'm really aiming this at people who are leading in your organisation and who have the ability to, you know, ask some really good questions of those in the most senior positions of power. What are your intentions and actions with regard to racial equality in your organisation? And what are you doing in relation to enacting them? And I want you to consider that through the lens of how and who you partner and contract with, how you invest your capital, and how you make decisions. The litmus test really, I think, is, are you helping to deconstruct the system that keeps things as is, and ultimately therefore reconstructing a system that is based on greater equality? And what do the holders of power in your organisation represent in relation to racial equality? And in that, I mean, you know, by representation, how diverse are you? You know, who are your role models? What are your actions and what are your behaviour? And ultimately, you know, as I've worked with leaders in the last 10 years, and in particular on leadership and how and where inclusion and difference comes into leadership, my own frame for considering this is, I think there's actually three things we talk about. One is diversity, one is inclusion, and one is belonging. And the way that I talk about this is, diversity is the fact. You know, it's who gets invited to the meeting, who gets employed in the first instance, who gets promoted. So it's fact. You can measure that very clearly. Inclusion is an act. So you have, say, within your meeting, a good broad representation. But who gets asked to speak? Who gets listened to? Whose comments are acted upon or valued? And who perhaps isn't heard? Or has to have the comment picked up by somebody else? And the final one, and I would say most diversity and inclusion programs that I've seen aim at those first two, fact and act. But the final one that I would like you to consider in relation to your own organisation is belonging. If diversity is the fact and inclusion is the act, belonging is the feeling. Do I feel valued? Do I feel heard? Could I say something that represents the difference I bring in this group and not fear rejection? Or is my inclusion dependent on my behaviour and my opinions? I think most organisations these days have some focus, if not formal programme or policies related to diversity and inclusion. And I think there has been an undercurrent where it feels as though there's a standard that's set and, you know, it's kind of a, there'll be consequences if you don't live up to that standard. And of course, if the standard is that we are all treated equally and that we don't discriminate, that seems, you know, pretty obvious to most people. And yet if it was as simple as overt racism, microaggressions, or the term that the UK uses, I think a little more often, is minor incivilities. So there's daily grievances or snubs that people of colour and black people endure day in, day out as part of their life experience, then I think that would seem a far easier set of targeted interventions to make. And yet we know that because this is implicit or unconscious bias, where it's not necessarily recognised cognitively by those that are perpetrating it, it's not as simple as targeting overt racism. I think the reality is we have to, to further this conversation, we have to rely on engaging rather than controlling. There was an interesting paper back in 2016 called Why Diversity Programs Fail. And it talks through, you know, the approach which has become kind of carrot and stick, you know, where you can't just outlaw bias or tell people that bias is wrong and then, you know, force them to do performance rankings or face grievance procedures alone. There has to be some sense of how do we better engage people to recognise the cognitive dissonance, if you like, between someone's beliefs and their behaviour. And that isn't through penalties and fear and further hiding this. And please don't hear this wrongly. I'm not saying that there isn't a role if bias or discrimination is found, that there should be penalties and procedures that support inquiry and learning. But to my mind, there can't be penalties alone. There has to be some form of engagement where people are actively supporting a more diverse population rather than feeling like they're being held accountable to a standard that they don't actually subscribe to. We know that management is one of the critical levels that determine how an organisation, you know, feels in practice to work. And there was a McKinsey report done last year, 2019, that talks about that there's a missing rung on the ladder. And it was that first step into management, there was a clear gap for women and Black people and people of colour. So even at that very first stage, that's where it started. Even if there were, you know, good recruitment records, and even to an extent, some significant improvements when you got up to C-suite, there showed to be quite a reduction in the number of women and people of colour that were promoted comparative to white men on that first rung of management. So there's something about focusing on that layer in your organisation, not to penalise, but to engage them and use them to act in positions of recruitment or mentoring or diversity task forces. So they're actually part of the progress rather than feeling that they're subject to something that other people are responsible for and imposing on them. One of the other aspects the article Why Diversity Programs Fail touched on was to increase contact between racial groups. So rather than keeping the various sort of marginalised voices separate, you know, it's the stepping into this being a collective issue, not just, you know, for single groups to fix themselves. One example of this is the distinction, I think, between a network that is set up to support a particular minority group. So it might be minority ethnic, it might be women, it might be disability, it might be sexuality. The networks often serve a function to allow people to come together who share a common experience. But the networks are not the same thing as task forces that are a collection and representation across the entire organisation with the intention of improving, whether it's racial inequality, gender inequality, or any other minority representations experience. And so for me, it's really important that, you know, networks serve an important role, but they're not the same thing as a task force. And we all have a role to play in a task force. The final point that was made was the importance of social accountability at an organisational level. And this really meant the transparency of measures and progress. And it was found to play a real difference where parts of an organisation knew that they were going to have to share the results of whether they had made an improvement in, say, pay gap analysis or promotion rates if their peers were able to see and hold them to account. Which, of course, takes us to the question within your organisation of what is it that you currently are measuring? You know, there can't be any level of understanding of progress if you don't measure the data in the first place. And so the extent to which you gather data, and this for me seems quite an important point to mention, the concept of intersectionality. And intersectionality means understanding the impact when somebody represents beyond one marginalised group. So, for example, it could be a Black woman with a disability. I think typically diversity programmes tackle one aspect or isolate those aspects and tackle them individually rather than bringing those together and saying, actually, what we might offer a Black male may not actually be appropriate to offer a Black female, or certainly not appropriate to offer an Asian female. And so understanding the specificity within whatever groupings that your organization may make can be really, really important. So to what specificity does your organization gather that data, and what do they then do with that data? How is it used? I have worked with an organization that has very high and you know, growing engagement rates across its population, and yet a persistently strong harassment and discrimination rate. And if you look into the detail behind it, you can see that it is typically minority groupings that are overrepresenting, if you like, within the harassment and discrimination. And so for me, there has to be a really serious conversation, not just about a generic anti-bullying, but a race conversation and a conversation about sexuality. And, you know, we're not used to having those uncomfortable conversations at work. And yet, if we do want to create a society and a, you know, our set of organizations within society that are inherently not just more just, but better able to perform, then we have to step into these uncomfortable conversations, and we have to stop pitting the individual minority groups as they show up on diversity and inclusion programs against each other. You know, it can't just be that it's this year is the year for race and we'll just put on hold LGBTQ for now. Or, you know, we've done enough on women for a while, so we're going to focus on disability. We have to recognise that these things are at play all the time. And that's the complexity of how do we hold collective responsibility to allow this to shift for everyone forward. Look, I know these aren't easy conversations, nor sometimes easy concepts or histories to, you know, learn and understand or unlearn and relearn. I have seen, even through the short time I've been doing these podcasts, that some people either want to step into that space and others really don't want to go near that space. I truly believe that we have the ability to use our organisations for social good. Indeed, I think it's through organisations that we make those steps forward in society. But it does mean that we're going to have to step into what are inherently uncomfortable conversations. And that does take courage. But, you know, as we look at our children, and I see the reflection, if I were to ask them what we should do, it's such an obvious answer that says, well, of course you should stand up for and enter into these conversations, because they shouldn't be having to have them in 20, 30 years' time. It's our turn. There isn't a time where we're waiting for social justice. It's just us. And it's now. I hope there's been something that you find interesting to examine, either at the individual level in relation to your own biases and behaviour, and at your organisational level, to understand, you know, where is your organisation now and what is its intention and action to make progress going forward. If you want to continue this conversation, please do get in touch. I think it is a conversation better done together than alone. So feel free to contact me through LinkedIn or through my website, futureulimited.co.uk. I look forward to speaking to you soon. Goodbye. If you want to share your thoughts or ask any questions, you can get in touch with me on LinkedIn, Instagram or Twitter under Debbie Waith. I'll post any references I make in the podcast on my website, Future You, under Team Time Resources, and a new podcast will be released every Tuesday. I hope you'll subscribe to join me.
Subscribe to Team Time.